Today, a few final provocations from the Hannah Arendt book I have most recently read.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Book is The Human Condition. We introduced it last time, talked about some of the ideas behind it, so I will not spend a lot of time going back over all of that. I encourage you to go back and listen to the first episode if you didn't. I think it'll be a little confusing not to have that foundation laid. But the point is that by the time we got to the end of the conversation about it, recognizing not only that human beings exist, humans be, but also that humans do. And the being and doing are all tied together. Part of that was just laying the foundation for understanding why it's so important that our understanding of what we do can be so significant. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, as a believer, a follower of Christ, I'm wanting to give my life back to God. And I want to be before Him the thing that He wanted me to be when He created me. And to say that only about my being is not to understand what He created in me, because He created me as a beer and a doer. And so I want to do both of those. I want to live in both of those, which means understanding what it means to fulfill my humanity. I think The Human Condition, this book by Hannah Arendt, really makes the point of what it is that we do in a way that allows us to analyze it and sort of see if we're actually accomplishing anything. And so here, I want to go back through the three big categories that she puts this in: labor, work, and action. Those are the three categories. Cement in our minds the difference between them, but also then give us a way of looking at ourselves and saying, is the way I live in my labor, in the process of life, the day-to-day mundane iterations of life that involve consumption and production and so on, am I living that in a way that I give back to God that's meaningful, giving it back to Him? And so I want to start with labor and then just work our way through to work and then to action. And again, labor is that part of our life that's about a rhythm. It's the rhythm of life that you experience in a basically endless cycle. I mean, obviously it ends when you die, but then you're just part of that cycle for the longer period of humanity. So the idea of being a part of labor in your life sounds like it just objectifies us, but it doesn't. I mean, part of being human is that I am the same kind of animal that all the other humans are. That's just part of who I am. I can't pretend that eating is not a part of being human. If I don't eat, I die and I stop praying, you know, at least in this world. It's a part of being human. And so the labor part of life is the part of life, this day-to-day labor. And again, we talked last time about how some of those things fit together, because labor and the way that word also fits with the concept of reproduction. Concept for me, I'm a man. I don't have to go through all the things that a person goes through who actually goes through labor, right? But the point is that those are not coincidentally related. They're historically related and in more than one language. And the idea of labor also involves toil and the things that come with what we read in the description of the fall in the garden. So we kind of talked about some of that in the last episode leading up to this. But the point for us is to pause and just examine the part of your life that wouldn't have to be uniquely you, but it is you. It's a part of you. It's a part of who you are in the world and how you interact with everyone else inherently. So, I mean, and on this part, I mean And again, the words that go with it are when we are just participating in the world, when we're producing things that can be consumed or consuming the things that were produced, or we're in the process of a cycle that entails somehow the destruction of all the things that are involved in it. And, you know, I mean, I've done a lot of funerals, so we're all involved in that because we're all destroyed in the end. I mean, the physical part of us. And so, you know, this part, the process part, I mean, you can think of the mundane things that you do every day, walking the dog. It doesn't matter that it's you walking the dog. I mean, you could buy a good robot and have it walk the dog. But there is something about that process of circling the block or, you know, carrying the baggies, the things that go with walking a dog that fulfill a pattern in life that's fairly satisfying. The number of people who do it, I don't want to dwell on walking the dog, but I mean, whatever it is, filling your car with gas or just sitting down at certain times of the day and having your meal. Who doesn't know that as obviously having a meal is consuming. So it's a part of this cyclical way that we participate in life along these lines. And the idea of labor is that you're expending energy that needs to be replaced by something. And so you consume something. And the nature of it is sort of agrarian in its perspective. You know, you plant things in the ground, they grow, you harvest them, and you're exhausted, so you eat them. And that gives you more energy to go plant some more things in the ground that grow, and then you eat them, and so on. That type of process or cycle, it doesn't end. You don't have a harvest and say, oh, okay, we're done being farmers. You're not finished. You don't have a product that's concluded. You make something that is then consumed and is a part of the cycle of starting it all over again and doing it again. And that is a part of what our daily life cycle is like. I mean, you get up in the morning and you have a meal and you use some energy, and then you need another meal and you use some more energy and you need another meal, and you've accomplished something and now you're exhausted and you need to go back to sleep. And so the pattern of life is just going on. You know what? You're not the only person who has that pattern in life. You know what I like to do? I like to sleep at night. That's not going to be a very interesting conversation. Everybody likes to sleep at night. I know there are some weirdos out there, but you get the idea. Have all of those patterns in life, they don't make you unique. They don't make you distinct. I mean, you might do it slightly differently than someone else, but I mean, get in the flow of traffic and you understand how much we're just part of the flow of humanity that's constantly going on. That's okay. I'm saying it with a little disgust in my voice, but I don't mean it at all. It's a really meaningful part of life. So I'll take myself. I've been preaching since I was 16 years old when I was called to ministry. I've been writing sermons and then delivering the sermon and then thinking about the consequences of the sermon as I start writing the next sermon and then delivering that sermon and then thinking about the consequences of that sermon. The Sunday sermon for me, and it's not always on Sundays, but for the pattern of so many years, decades, so much of the preaching was built around what I did on Sunday. Sunday morning in particular, that event has become a cyclical pattern in my life. And when I think about some of the people I've known, and you've known as well, and I mean famous people, W.A. Criswell, the man after whom the school that I'm the president of is named, W.A. Criswell was this way and preached into his very late years, well into his 80s. And even when he'd lost all the strength and vigor of life, if you put him behind a pulpit and said, preach, he was just like he was when he was 50 or 60 years old. I mean, he was going great guns and perfect clarity, and the words flowed meaningfully. And people talk about an experience with Billy Graham the same way, so feeble he could barely stand up, but they propped him up and stood him up behind a pulpit one day, and man, just out came the standard sermon that you would expect from a Billy Graham. That's part of the nature of developing this process of life. It doesn't matter what was going to be preached. If you put me behind a pulpit today and I don't have any time to prepare a sermon is still going to come out. I know how to speak for 35 minutes. That's a joke. I know how to preach for 45 minutes, and I'm going to preach for 45 minutes. And it's part of, you know, anyway, that event for me, the sermon on Sunday morning, is partially what it is simply because of the cyclical pattern that's involved with it. It is, and by the way, it is for me, a speech event. It's not the sermon as a work of art. It's not something I'm hoping, oh, I want to publish that sermon and make sure everyone can read it. That's not what a sermon is to me. It is that experience that happens on Sunday morning when the congregation is listening and I'm delivering it, and I have goals, I have aspirations for the influence it will have, but it is that interaction with the congregation that makes that moment a part of what it is. It's why I focus much more on the speech event, and I'll talk about this in terms of a class later on when we're talking about works that we do, products that we actually make, in a way that fits that pattern as well. But the point is, it's just part of the workaday life. You know, it's time to show up and do that speech thing that we do on Sunday morning. I don't mean by that that it's not spiritual, that I don't pray about it, that it doesn't make a difference, that it's not prophetic, that it's not hugely and eternally important. I don't mean any of that. But I do mean there's a part of it that's the pattern of my life. And getting in the car and driving somewhere is the same way. For the congregant, by the way, and I'm not a congregant very often, or I just go sit in church and get to see what happens when you're a church member, but I do get to occasionally, now that I don't pastor, I do interims and things like that, I know what it is to be the congregant. And, you know, I remember a long time ago hearing people talk about, and this was a day when more people, a higher percentage of people in every community went to church. And a part of the flow, the pattern that was built in those communities was that on Sunday morning, you saw people get their car out and the whole family go and get in the car and drive to church on Sunday. And it didn't matter which church they were going to, and you don't know what kind of sermon they heard, and you don't know what their doctrine was, but everybody knew that everybody was going to church on Sunday morning, and all the restaurants were going to be full after church on Sunday morning, and all the families were going to have their ties on and their bonnets and their flowers and their lapels and all that stuff was a part of the pattern of life. And it helps establish who we are as a people and a community and as individuals who fit into that process when we understand it that way. So I'm just trying to paint the picture of what this idea of labor is about. If you think of it in the technical, I don't mean technical, but in the economic way that we think about labor, it is the person with a job that's putting widgets together, you know? So, well, I got to put this sprocket in that hole and put A through B and slide them together and then lubricate it and then start the machine. Go, okay, now I've done that. Okay, now I got to do it again. All right, let's get the screw and let's get the, you know, the nut and put the washer on and then the, okay, now I've done it again. Now I got to do it another time. The idea of an assembly line, the idea of a person simply doing a repetitive task over and over, that's the idea of labor in this context. But it applies to all the things we do in life that are just a part of a routine, a regular practice. And again, I'm not criticizing it, and I'm not objectifying us. I'm not making us less than human by acknowledging that we are fully human, and that a part of being fully human is having a pattern of repetition and constancy that makes your life, and I'll use the word, but again, I don't mean it harshly, routine, that makes it something that follows a pattern, because you're designed that way. We have day after day and week after week, the cycles of the calendar are a part of telling us that we live our lives in this routine where we follow a pattern. The fact that you have to eat a meal and eat another meal and eat another meal makes the same point. So, you know, if I put that into something on the spiritual side, it's the idea of a patterned, regular, predictable, daily, devotional type of life. The spiritual disciplines are often built around, a big part of the spiritual disciplines are built around regularity. And so, I mean, obviously, the content of something is important. You know, what you read in a chapter of Scripture when you're reading, doing your daily Bible reading, is important. But it's more than that. It's the routine of a process that entails giving the rest of what we'll do that day to the purpose of God. That's just as important as the actual thing that you learned from reading the text that day. You get the picture I'm painting, right? So you read a specific passage and you learn something specific. Don't be angry today. Be slow to speak. You know, that kind of thing. Okay, fine. I'm going to try to apply that today. But an equally important part of what happened in that moment is that when you got out of bed, you said to yourself, I need to figure out what God wants me to do today. And whatever that was going to be, whatever advice he was going to give you from Scripture, how do you like that? Advice. God gives advice from Scripture. Anyway, the point is that it's just as important that you have the routine that establishes that pattern of commitment, that establishes where you fit in the process of the world that day. Well, I'm one of those people that follows God, you know? So in one sense, that moment isn't about those few minutes that you spent with God, but about spending every, in the language of David in the Psalms, evening and morning and at noon, I will pray and cry aloud, you know? It's that spending every evening and morning and noon in a pattern of life that acknowledges the Lordship of Jesus. And, you know, I think before, you know, criticizing the repetitive ingredients that are in our Christian lives, which a lot of us do, you know, well, you're just doing a routine. You're just stuck in a pattern. You're not even thinking through what you're doing. You know, we might consider the value of that process of submission and our role in that process. When you go to church, singing the same hymns, saying the same prayers, hearing the same passages at church, you might want to beat somebody over the head and like, I'm tired of hearing that song and I'm tired of that repetition. But that repetition is incredibly valuable as well. It sets a pattern in your life that says, and again, I never favored these kinds of things. I never thought of these things as even important. I always thought it was more important to change things up. When I go to churches as an interim, very often I'm saying to them, you got one way you do services. Can't you ever change it? Let's change it. Let's put the offering at the beginning. Let's have the baptism at the beginning. Let's sing the songs at the end this time. I try to shake things up. So, I mean, that's my personality is to do things like that. But it's so misguided to think that that's the only thing that's important. There's no way on earth to read the Old Testament and not hear God saying to the people in Israel, I want you to memorize these prayers, memorize these songs, memorize these commandments, and repeat them rote to your children every meal that you have so they learn to quote them back to me so that the pattern of our life is part of the testimony to his lordship and his presence with us all the time. This is why we celebrate the same holidays. We don't say at the end of a year, you know, we've done Christmas 20 years in a row. Let's do something different this year. No, I mean, Christmas is the holiday. And when it's time for Christmas, you rotate it back around to Christmas. So think about how much, and think about, even just think about Christmas itself for a second. And I do mean in the material kind of gift exchange kind of sense to make this point. Think about how much of our holidays is actually about the process of having the holiday and not something that remains, something that made it important. So even, and I mean that literally in terms of the gifts we exchange, I could not point out, I mean, 5 gifts that I've received over the last 61 years of my life that I still have. It's not about having a product. It's about that moment when everybody passes them around and you exchange them and you might as well give them something that they're going to consume. It is the process of the exchange, of the gift giving that makes the Christmas holiday what it is. Otherwise, you just, you know, some people do this. Give them a gift card and let them go shopping. You know, who cares about the rest? Anyway, you get the idea. It's not the stuff. It is the process. Even the gift card. Why do you give them a gift card? Why do you know, what's the point of that? They've got money. You've got money. Hey, you know what? I was going to give you 50. How much were you going to give me? 30? Okay, well, let's just exchange 20 and be done with it, all right? It's not a matter of the net benefit or loss. It's a matter of the process of the exchange. That's what I'm saying, that there are parts of our lives that are made important, not distinct. We're not different from everyone else because of it. In fact, we're like everyone else because of it. Anybody can put a nut and a washer and a nut. Well, I said nut. a washer and a nut. I was trying to say a lock washer and a flat washer, okay? There are three things. Anybody can put a flat washer, a lock washer, and a nut on a screw. Not everybody can say it. Anyway, the point is, anybody can do that, and yet it's still got to be done. That's the point. And it's the same thing with your eating and sleeping and the pattern of your life, and think about what that means to the people who are part of your life. These are the things that you can do, but really anyone else could also do if they just fit the same pattern of living that you happen to be filling. But that doesn't make them unimportant. So for instance, in ministry, in my personal ministry career, and I'm inclined to go do things that make a difference. So it's like, I don't want to. Why am I going to go sit with somebody and hold their hand in the hospital? I mean, what's the point of that? Somebody else can go sit with them in the hospital and hold their hand. Well, of course somebody else could. But the point of it being me is that I can also do it. I can do it just like someone else. And I can be there saying to someone, not, I can solve your problem, not, I can make you feel better, but you're not alone. I'm with you. You're not alone doesn't require me to have a degree. It doesn't require me to have a title. I don't have to have been ordained. And yet I can sit there just like anybody else could have and be exactly who I need to be in that place simply by being present. We talked about the ministry of presence. I've had that conversation in other episodes, so I won't go through it again. But, you know, in the same way, think about how much kids need a predictable, stable, daily life. Let's just get up at this time and have a meal and know that you're going to go to bed not hungry and that you've got somebody who's going to listen to the things that you went through today and care about what's happening in you, in your life, and keep you safe and so on. All those things can be provided by somebody else, but they're being provided by you. And you happen to be the person who lives in a pattern of life that allows them to experience that as well. That's part of who we are in the world. We fit together with other people in a pattern of behavior that allows for a stability that gives us then the freedom to participate in these other parts of life that we need to talk about as well. So on the labor side, you can hear how, in terms of the process of life, and in labor, that's the big thing that we're talking about. What's the process of your life? What's the routine of your life? Are you giving the routine of your life, the pattern of your life, does that also belong to God? Is that something that testifies to his presence and importance in what's going on with you? Is it part of the lordship of Jesus in your life? Now, that's not Hannah Arendt's question, obviously, but that's my question, based on that being a part of who we are, because I need to acknowledge that a part of who I am is a creature that lives in processes that involve participating and producing and consuming and ultimately destruction and then starting over again. And I want all of those parts of my life to belong to God as well. Anyway, we can do more about it another time. The second category is work. So we talked about labor, now we're talking about work. In the economic sense, you can hear the difference of what I mean, because in the sense of labor, you know, it's just being a part of the process of production and consumption and so on. But in the process of work, this is why I mentioned last time, we use the word work also to mean the product. So the work of your hands. So a piece of pottery is a work of art is the word we use for what someone has produced, for this work that somebody put out from their work. And it wasn't just labor. It's not just, you know, it's not paint by numbers. Not mocking it, just making the point that you can have anybody do the paint by numbers and get exactly the same thing if you do it precisely the way you're supposed to, just like putting nuts on screws. That's not what this is. Nuts on bolts, I know, difference. But anyway, the point is, that's not what I mean by a work of art. I mean something that a person produces from the skill of their hands, not that that's without any skill, and there is a durable product that comes from it, so that's fine. But the things that you know, this kind of work is what we do that results in the things that people encounter in the world. That's what we mean by a work. It's the things that remain in the world that sort of create the context, the shape within which people experience the world. The fact that I'm sitting on a chair, this is somebody's work. Somebody made this chair, and now it's a part of shaping the world that I live in. And the way Hannah Arendt talks about it in this book, by the way, in The Human Condition, artists are, in our world, one of the only groups that we automatically categorize in this way, to say that they are primarily makers. They are the people who just produce things, because what they produce that remains is most durable in the part of it that's not consumed in any way, that never does go away. And so you visualize, you see the work of art or something like that. But, you know, it's makers in general, people who are making stuff. And it's not, again, not stuff that's consumed, but of course, everything's destroyed in the end because we're in a transient world. But I mean by it, it's not in its nature to be destroyed by using it. My chair is not supposed to be consumed by my sitting on it. It is, because I weigh a little too much and I sit a little too hard and wiggly in it. But the reality is that the chair is designed to endure that. And when it breaks down, it's because something's gone wrong with it. It's not a consumable product. That's not what it's supposed to be. And so I would put music in the same category, not the performance. The performance does fit this category in some ways because it becomes a mental object that does stay with you. But I mean primarily, you know, a piece of music as a composition, the piece that endures, and it can be performed here and there and this way and that way, but it's still this underlying composition that was put together. That would be something someone has made. And again, it's an example of art. A sermon, and to come back, I was giving a labor example before, where one of the things that my sermons are is just a speech event that happens on Sunday morning. And if you put me behind a pulpit, you know, I'm going to exude this sermon. And 99% of the time, nobody's going to remember what I said afterwards. I'm not saying that in a self-deprecatory manner. I just mean it's a reality of public speaking. Most of the time, people can't remember what somebody said after they said it. They experienced it in the moment. It has an impact on them. It's still meaningful. But at the end of the day, if you say to them, now, what did he say? They're like, well, you know, he talked about something to do with, I don't know, birds and something with work and, you know, I don't know, vote this way or that. Something like that. Anyway, whatever it was. But in the moment, they experienced. So I talked about it as a process like that, as part of who we are as, you know, laborers. We're in the process. But this is different than that. There are elements of it that have to do with producing something that's residual, something that's durable, something that remains behind. So there is a difference between, you know, an average workaday Sunday sermon. And again, I'm saying this about myself, because, you know, I'm a preacher. And so but there's a difference between that everyday sermon and then, you know, R.G. Lee's Payday Someday, which is dated, and I'm not trying to say, oh, that's the greatest sermon ever preached or something like that, but there is something about that sermon, maybe the most famous sermon from the 20th century, preached hundreds of times and printed and put out in books and, you know, examined and, you know, so on, all of that. It became a durable product, and that's different than the experience of preaching it on Sunday morning. And when I think of a lot of the pastors I know and some of the former students I had who are turning a sermon into a book or turning a sermon series into a book, and that's the goal, is to get it on someone's shelf, that's sort of the difference here. Then it's not about something that's just a part of the process of every week, you know, we go and we stir each other up to good works, and that's part of our process of being able to follow the Lord. There's that on the labor side, but on the other side, there is this desire, I think, among some to produce something durable and say, you know, I want a book on a shelf where a person can open it up and see, oh, look at the work that they accomplished. Look at the thing that they produced. Not to pat them on the back, but to say there was something meaningful and durable that came from this. I mean, the fact that we regard Scripture the way we do is part of the evidence of that. The fact that some bibliophiles think it's a big deal to smell the mold in the book when they open it is part of the testimony to that. We like the durable part of what comes as the result of the work of a person's hands, something about their technical skill, and then now they've contributed to shaping the world for us so that we have a different place to live in than we would have before. It's part of the challenge, as I mentioned, I would bring up my class. I'm teaching ethics this semester. This is fall of 2024, if you're listening to this much later. And in my ethics class, I mean, I teach it over and over again. And normally when I teach a class, it is the same way I preach a sermon. And I don't mean I preach to my classes or even that I just lecture in my classes. They're very much discussion oriented. I don't always get to the discussion because sometimes the, you know, the questions that I ask are basically sermon length. But the point is that I believe in using the class the same way I think Sunday mornings work for us. If Sunday worship, let me put it this way before I get to the class. If Sunday worship were just about, you know, what do you get what I said in this sermon? And do you understand the 3 points? And have you applied them? And are you going to live them out for your whole? Then it wouldn't matter that we meet every Sunday. Sunday is about every Sunday. It's not about that Sunday. The point of doing it every week is that that pattern of life of stirring one another up to good works, as the author of Hebrews puts it, that we provoke one another to love and to good works. That's part of the pattern of living. And that's a lot of what I do with my classes normally. I'm not trying to produce something that remains on the shelf. I'm not trying to produce something where the students leave and they go, oh, yeah, I memorized the 100 things from that class, so now I know how to be an ethical person. That's not my goal in these classes. I use each class in that semester, and I mean each meeting in that semester, in sort of a rhythm of sensing where the students are and then cajoling them towards some self-awareness and changes of mind and heart so that they understand then how to function. It's very much a process, not just an end product that I'm looking for. That would fit under the category of labor, you know, in that process of life kind of stuff. Well, this semester, I'm actually recording the class for the sake of making it something that we can share with other people in, you know, online courses and stuff like that. And that's going to be a challenge for me because recording the class means creating a durable product. And it won't be different in the way that I do it, but it will be a little odd for me because my goal in the class is interacting with those students, figuring out where they are, asking questions. Ah, so you don't get the difference between this and that. And even the idea of using that kind of differentiation for this student as a way to offer something recorded and durable for students who might take it in 4 years is different. That's a different type of product than what I'm doing in the process of teaching a class with students who are actually sitting in the room with me. Mentoring is a different kind of goal than just having a class, right? So that, I think, is part of what I'm describing as the difference here. But, you know, you can all, so I'm saying part of who we are as human beings, part of what God made us to be is people who can make things, who can make durable things. And so this makes people feel weird because, like, pottery, some people can do, some can't. I have a daughter who's brilliant with pottery. She made me a Mobius band out of clay, and it's beautiful. I have it in my office. We should take a picture and put it on the website. Anyway, the point is, she's talented at that. So she's making products, selling the product that sits on a person's shelf, or it's used for this or that in their daily life, but they don't use it and throw it away. They use it, and then they put it on the shelf, and they wash it, or they wash it, and then they put it on the shelf, and then they use it again, and so on. That durable product is part of having shaped the world with her hands. There's more than just those concrete types of products. There are ideas that become part of shaping our world, and someone creating a durable idea can do that. I think there's a way of thinking of this also in terms of being part of a discipline. So providing, you know, when you become part of a skill set, you become a professional, for instance, a doctor or a dentist or a plumber or a lawyer or whatever it is that you go into in your discipline. When you become a part of that and you learn that durable skill and you do more with it than just produce something so that you can consume something, but you actually maintain the quality and meaningfulness of that discipline itself. Hey, this is our heritage. This is our background. This is what we pass down from one person to the next in our generations of maintaining this discipline. when you're providing continuity for a durable skill like that. And that's what happens with counseling or math or engineering. When you learn it, you become a person who not only uses it, you consume it, you share it with other people in your use of it, but you become a person where that resides and it becomes part of the potential within you to be able to share that with the next generation of people who are able to do it. It's all the things where you would say it's caught, not taught, you know, the things that come from an experience where you have to be mentored or discipled by somebody in doing it. And so you could think of this as the profession or skilled part of what you do. And it's made as important by the fact that you received it as that you will bestow it on someone who's following you. And it's more than just, again, teaching a consumable, like, you know, I do a consumable lecture, but, you know, mentoring, discipling, it's a durable gift. It's a bestowment. It's, I think, part of what's going on in the imagery of laying on of hands in an ordination service. You know, when you say to someone, I've received this, and now we've seen that you've received it, and we're going to demonstrate that this invisible but meaningful object of reality is being passed from one person to another. And by the way, it's also more than that. It's not, because even that could be just pictured as a part of the process. You know, human beings are consumed in the process of maintaining plumbing skills in the world. It's not just that, and I'm not mocking plumbing skills. I have the greatest respect for people who have that skill. But it's not just that. It's also the personalization that you can bring to that skill, that you make things unique in the way you do them. It's why we would think of a signature on something like this. So all of that has to do with that part of us that's making things and putting them into the world. Well, I meant to spend most of my time on this third category, so I'll be sort of brief with it, but we can cover it and finish. And it's the category of action. So do we give that back to God? So, you know, on the first two, I'm saying, is the process of your life a testimony to giving your life back to God? Does your daily routine testify to the Lordship of Jesus? Secondly, are the things you're producing a part of what you're giving back to God? The things that you do that contribute to the durable shape of the world that everyone else lives in, the products you make, the things that you make that influence what other people have to interact with in the world, are those things a part of the testimony that your life belongs to God? And then finally, action. And again, by action, it's more than just, you know, labor and work. This is us interacting with other people in speech, in word and deed. You know, we'll use that category, that way of saying it. And if I were to put it in the language of Kierkegaard or Richard Rorty even, and those are on the far ends of the spectrum of sort of existential thought, Rorty more postmodern type thought. But the point is that it would be doing more than just being a part of the herd. And again, I'm not even saying being a part of the herd insultingly today, because you're part of the herd because you're part of the process of life. We're part of the herd because we eat bread, right? I mean, it's just the nature of life. But this is not that part of us. And this is not just the part that converts something into a durable product. This is the part of us that interacts with other human beings in a way that disrupts the way things were going to be without us, so that we actually contribute to humanity by being different than the rest of humanity. Not obtuse, not obstinate, not seeking some way to have purple hair instead of brown hair. I don't care if you have purple hair or brown hair. Happy with both. My point is, that's not what I mean by the difference. I mean it's you being uniquely you in your interaction with other people. It's the unique things that you bring to pass by you, specifically you, participating in a conversation, speaking an opinion. You know, everybody's got a plan and it's going this way, and you interrupt it. Not because you're trying to be disruptive. Maybe you are, maybe you're not. But just because you participate and it changes the way that plan is going to flow. It's you entertaining a guest. Someone shows up and you say, oh, let's talk. Tell me your story. Let me tell you my story. You change their life because now they know your story, or they know you know their story. Every part of that you just share an idea, you entertain an idea with another person. That's part of you uniquely contributing to the fabric that humanity has in this world, but to the thing that makes it more than a fabric, that gives it tears and character and personality, wornness, like genes, you know, it's that kind of thing. That is, allow the person that God made you to shape the humanity that God made us. That's the point. He didn't just make you a part of the mass. He made you uniquely and distinctly a part of this mass. And that, you know, that's important. It's the reason you have dignity instead of price. You can't be replaced. There is no one else who can be who you are. And no matter how many people we try to put into that role, it won't work. We've talked about that in other episodes. The point here is that, let me give an example of what I mean by this and how important it is. The best leaders, when you're in a collaborative setting, let's sit around the table and let's figure this out. You know, let's solve this problem. The best leaders in that collaborative setting where everyone's going to sit around the table and we're going to have a meeting, get our heads together and solve this problem. The best leaders in those rooms are the people who are watching the room and who observe who's not involved, who's not contributing, and then they involve them. Now, I'll say two things about this. One, on the part of that leader, that's action. That's changing the whole room because they're participating in a way that no one else is participating in. But additionally, the thing that makes that so valuable is that the reason you have that room full of people is because you need all the people who are in that room. That's the point of getting them around the table. And so getting that one person who wasn't involved involved, and therefore making it a better meeting because they got involved, is a perfect analogy for what this world is. We're all supposed to be engaged in it. We're all supposed to be interacting with each other. We're all supposed to bring our idea or our ear or our participation and response or whatever it is, because that's why he made us that. It's not a bad description of what Christ's mission in the world is. He came into the world, so here he is observing, and then he went to the disinherited, to use Howard Thurman's term to identify them, Jesus and the Disinherited. Beautiful book. You have to read it. If you haven't read it, you got to read it. One of the most influential books in the 20th century on the civil rights movement. Anyway, Jesus comes into the world, goes to the disinherited, and then includes them. Basically, he's the guy sitting at the table saying, hey, you're not participating. And it's not a matter of making for a better meeting. God created the world with all these people in it because he wanted them participating in it. So he came into the world, found the people who were being excluded or who were just not participating, and said, hey, belly up to the table here. Come on up. Let me get you involved. Let me bring you in. Let me give you what you didn't have before. He included them. And we end that story as if their inclusion is the only thing that matters. But the point is that he created them, not just to be included, but so that once included, their uniqueness could shape the rest of the body. That's the microcosm for all of humanity. God created every single person to shape every part of humanity. That's what applies to us. We're not here just to be here. We're here so that our endless processes, day-to-day routine, can provide for us and others. So that our work can shape the way people see and live in their world. So that our presence, our choices, and our actions can make all of us together more like Christ than we'd be without each other. The language in Colossians 3, right? Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. You know, when we're singing those songs, that's part of the process. It's just everybody singing the same words. We're all just putting the nut on the bolt, right? But it's part of a process that allows us to give this all back to God. They're singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God, all doing that together. But then it's whatever you do in word or deed, our actions, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. That's what I want these analytic tools, these facets of our existence to give us the ability to do, to look at our labor and the process involved with that, our work and the products that are involved with that, our action, the deeds and words involved with that, as one way to examine your own life for what God is or may want to be doing with you.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.